Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. On September 11th, 1857, Mormon settlers in southern Utah massacred more than 120 men, women, and children, then secreted away 17 infants and children, survivors, victims, into settlers' homes. This massacre at Mountain Meadows was hushed up, was not talked about, and Julie Jensen, a playwright, her play Two-Headed, is in part about growing up, living in the shadow of the massacre. Two-Headed is being produced on the Utah State University campus this week, and there are other events to go along with it. Tomorrow is a good day to come and see the play, because along with the play, 5 o'clock preceding it, there's a screening of the film Burying the Past by filmmaker Brian Patrick, and following the play, a panel discussion by my guests here today. So we'll preview that, and I have with me playwright Julie Jensen on the line. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Also, filmmaker Brian Patrick, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Brian Patrick, I believe you're still on the faculty there at the University of Utah, the Film Studies?
That's correct. Actually, it's the Film and Media Arts Department now.
Okay. And with me on the line as well, Richard Turley, who is author, along with Glenn Leonard and Ronald Walker, of Massacre at Mountain Meadows. Thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
And Richard Turley is in the Church History Department, I believe, Assistant Church Historian still, Mr. Turley?
That's correct.
For the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Let me start with Julie Jensen. This, the play Two-Headed, is in part about living in the shadow of this, isn't it? It takes two characters, sisters, over the course of, I believe, some 40 or 50 years. And, of course, the usual trials, polygamy, frontier living, but also living in the shadow of this tragedy.
Yes, you got it pretty well. They're not sisters, they're friends.
Oh, they're friends,
but,
okay.
But the rest of the description is absolutely right. Yeah, it's about, and one of them, it's, of course, a fictional piece, but one of them purports to have seen the massacre from the top of a tree. And so it's, in a sense, a post-traumatic stress play. I didn't write it consciously thinking that, but it's what these kinds of events do to people, what they do, even if you haven't seen them, when you're keeping a secret. And, of course, she had to keep a secret throughout the whole experience, and that's very wearing and debilitating.
Let me play an excerpt from an interview that we've been running. This is from our series with the Center for Women and Gender here at USU called Contemporary Western Women. And this is from an interview that Elaine Thatcher had with Julie Jensen for Contemporary Western Women, talking about the theme of the play.
The metaphor was, okay, I mean, I put the two-headed calf in there later because I named it because I didn't care if you actually got this or not, but how it feels to be hauling around a secret. How it feels to be two things. To know something and not know things. To know something and not talk about them. So that's what it meant. And I think we all have experience being two-headed. It's just about what. Mm-hmm. And so that was the reason it was named that. I had always been interested. My family was part of it. So it was one of those things you didn't speak of. And we talked about it. And you couldn't get Juanita Brooks's book, and my father had a copy of it, and he kind of shuttled it around the family, and they would kind of sit in the back room and talk about it. So it had this aura about it. The massacre always did have this weird aura.
In the play Two-Headed, the characters possess items that you later learn came from the massacred immigrants.
I was talking to my sister one day, and I said, you know, what the access to that story is is the stuff. It's the stuff that they got, you know, that they would have things. They would have weird stuff. And that would be the way into the story. And then as soon as I thought that up, I was done, because I could imagine, oh, of course, kids. And then what happens, kids who saw it or heard about it, or like me. It had an ominous feel about it. And then as soon as I knew that my access was those camisoles, in that case, it came easily after that.
That's an excerpt from Contemporary Western Women, which is being heard this month on Utah Public Radio. So Julie Jensen, two-headed at least means in part to know something and not know it. That must have been the atmosphere in Southern Utah growing up.
It was. Definitely was the atmosphere. We didn't ever talk about it, even though my family had been involved. My progenitor was William Dame, and he was a big part of the planning of it. He was part of the militia, in fact, in charge of the militia in Parowan, and he figures quite heavily in the whole development of events. He was not there that day, I must say that, and he has an affidavit that he was not there. But it still was something that we knew he was a part of, and yet we didn't talk about it, we didn't claim it, we didn't think about it in terms of our people. It was just something you carried around and didn't speak of.
Let me turn to my other two guests, starting with Richard Turley. I want to know from each of you how you came to a project related to Mountain Meadows Massacre. So, Mr. Turley, this book, and as I understand it, and I've interviewed before on this, this was okayed, I guess, by the church. They gave you full power to go wherever the evidence would lead.
I got involved in the Mountain Meadows Massacre back in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was working in the church's historical department. It's a case that has fascinated me for many years. I had read Juanita Brooks' book on the subject. And in the 80s and 90s, there was a kind of renaissance in Mountain Meadows studies, a lot of people studying, writing books, writing articles, and so forth. And I thought to myself, as a person who was inside the church history organization, you know, this would be a wonderful subject to tackle, because it's the worst, in my opinion, the worst incident in the church's past. And after 150 years, why don't we just face it square on and find out what happened, do thorough research, and then tell the world about it? Nobody alive today had anything to do with it. There has been too much of this effort that I've witnessed as I've interviewed people in Southern Utah to not talk about it, and I think it's much healthier to just get it out on the table and find out what happened.
What has been the reaction now? It's been a couple of years, I think, since the book has come out. What's been the reaction? Have you been attacked for getting some things wrong? Do you generally view it as getting it right?
The book has met, I think, a wonderful reception. I would say about probably 80 to 90% of the readers have liked it. I've gotten a lot of good feedback. It's sold very well. There have been some people on what I would call extreme ends of a spectrum who have not liked it. There have been some people on one end who haven't liked it because it has brought out the truth, and that truth has hurt. And there have been people at the other end who haven't liked it because they had a different perception and the truth hurt in a different way.
You bring up some interesting questions, which I hope we'll get to during this hour. In your preface, what does this atrocity say about the killers? What did it say about the church and its leaders? Did early Mormon pioneers possess a violent strain so deep and volcanic that it erupted without warning? What did it say about religion generally? Interesting questions. And how do we live with this? What does it mean? We'll get to these questions as we go along. Let me turn to Brian Patrick. How did you get involved in this subject?
Well, you know, I'm from Ohio originally and came to teach here in 1978. And avid hiker, and learned about the massacre through a guidebook of the Pria River area. And there was in that guidebook the story of John D. Lee and the Mountain Meadows Massacre, book by Michael Kelsey. And I thought to myself, wow, what an amazing story that I've never, ever heard about, and wouldn't it make a great movie? but I wasn't in the position to really go forward and make any sort of big dramatic film. I don't think I really wanted to, but then it's funny, 15 years later, I read the story in the Salt Lake Tribune about how these two groups of descendants had come together and were trying to reconcile, you know, the whole event, you know, in today's world, and, you know, trying to live with what had happened. And so you had descendants of the victims and descendants of the perpetrators really coming together to heal the wounds, which really struck me as like, you know, something very, very unique in today's world where everybody seems to be at war with each other. You know, and I thought about the Holocaust, and, you know, it always seemed kind of a miniature sort of version of the Holocaust. So that's how I got really involved.
And I believe your film is, you tell an actual documented account of a four-year-old girl.
Yes.
Who survived the massacre, and as several of the children were then raised in the homes of the perpetrators.
Right. There were 17 children that were picked up. They were under the age, I think they're around 5 or 6 years old. You know, like they didn't want to get anybody that could tell. And so they brought them into homes. And it's a really pretty amazing story about how this Nancy Sofrona talks about how she lived with this one family. And she could see her, you know, her mother's clothes being worn by.
Sounds like we may have lost Mr. Patrick. Are you there? Sounds like we'll have to try to reach Mr. Patrick again. Let me turn back to Julie Jensen. You mentioned in that excerpt that we heard Juanita Brooks' book. This is from, I think, 1950. She quite courageously, she's lived in southern Utah, lived in the communities, right? Wrote a book about it. This was, I guess, hush-hush. You talked about how your father had a copy of the book. They'd go in the back room to review it.
Yeah. It's one of the nice things now that the church and the Brooks's book are all legally looking at this. In those days, they didn't want people reading that book. Juanita Brooks was a very devout Mormon from southern Utah, the St. George area, and she remained a devout Mormon all her life. Also, she was a very accomplished historian. And she did a wonderful job with Mountain Meadows because she had known some of the people who were a part of it. That was the impetus for the book in the first place. So her research is extremely careful. I think certainly things have been added since then, but the foundation was laid by her. She really did a lovely job. And yes, you couldn't buy a copy of it in Utah during my growing up years.
Mr. Turley, you said you read the book. It impressed you.
Yes. One thing I was concerned about, however, when I read the book and when I read her biography and other information about her, was that she didn't get access to certain documents that she knew were in the church's possession. So as part of this project, one thing that I wanted to do and my colleagues wanted to do was not only find those documents, but use them in our book and make them publicly available. So after Massacre at Mountain Meadows was published, we actually published a second book called Mountain Meadows Massacre, the Andrew Jensen and David H. Morris Collections, that is a complete publication of all the documents that Juanita Brooks didn't get but wanted. We have in there both digital images of the documents and transcriptions. I think Juanita would have loved to have that copy in her possession when she wrote it.
When she comes back, she'll be in delight, yes.
Let me ask each of you, starting with Mr. Turley. I'm sure this has been on your mind. It's on the mind of everyone who learns of this tragedy, this massacre. These pioneers, these settlers, were persecuted themselves, were they not? They underwent killings and such. So how could they have done this?
Well, I think... Oh, go ahead, Julie.
Hold on. I'm in the middle of a room here that's a little bit different. Excuse me, could you restate your question?
The question I think everyone has is how could these Mormon pioneers have done this?
Well, you know, look at Mormon history. It's not like we've got a history that prepares us to say, well, you know, there certainly were violent people, yes. There were violent events. But, my God, there's never been a part of Mormon history that said, well, you know, we're gonna do it this way and we'll just be violent about everything. No. So it was a unique situation, yes. In 1857, the year this took place, the 24th of July celebration up in at Brighton was, the 10th year of the pioneers' initial coming to the Utah Valley. It was a celebration of that fact. Brigham Young invited a bunch of people from the city to come up and celebrate with them. There's a nice invitation in Turley's book, reprinted. But then when they get up there to celebrate the fact that they've survived 10 years, and very well, thank you, what does he have to announce? The army from the feds, the federal army, is on its way. Well, it's terrifying. It's just terrifying. And that is coupled with this wagon train that comes from Arkansas. And Arkansas had been the site of the death of Parley P. Pratt. They'd assassinated him, murdered him in Arkansas. So the time, it was a perfect storm in a way. The times were out of joint. And, cursed spite that anybody thought they should set it right. I mean, it was awful. And those times were scary, frightening. They thought they would have to abandon their cities, burn them, and move into the mountains. They were that prepared. And southern Utah was even more frightened than northern Utah.
Hmm. Mr. Turley, all this, these events and this atmosphere, I guess that can help explain perhaps the mindset. Do you connect any of that up with what actually happened?
Definitely. One thing that my colleagues and I did as we were writing our book, we wanted to find out what made people engage in mass killings around the world at various times in history, because the Mountain Meadows Massacre is a form of killing that's known as mass killing. So we studied the literature on the subject, and what we discovered was that there are certain factors which, when they come together in a perfect storm, as Julia said, tend to create a likelihood of mass killings occurring. One of those things is uncertainty, such as you have in the case of war. And as Julia's explained, these people felt that they were in a wartime environment. Another factor that comes to play is uncertainty about the future. You know, what's going to happen to us? Concern about their own personal safety. There were a lot of concerns about whether or not there was a branch of the army that was going to emerge from the canyons east of the Cedar City area. There were concerns about how they were going to survive in the event they had to have a prolonged guerrilla war. And all these factors together, along with a tendency of people to just sort of move forward without asking questions, which was certainly the environment that existed there in the Cedar City area at the time.
Mm. Of course, a lot of this can maybe explain the atmosphere. Nothing, of course, can excuse what these settlers did. And I'm sure you've had to grapple with how, you know, good, upstanding, religious people, how could they do this?
Have to grapple with that, and also I think it's very important for people to realize that this is inexcusable. There have been efforts made over the years, sometimes by relatives of those who carried out the atrocity, sometimes by members of our church wanting somehow to justify it, but this is completely inexcusable. I mean, these people made horrific decisions. We can try to understand the environment and the mental state that led to it, but in the end, Juanita Brooks got it right when she said, if you accumulate all of the accusations that had been made against these people, there wasn't sufficient information to justify the killing of a single person, let alone 120 men, women, and children, mostly women and children.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. September 11th, a previous September 11th, 1857 in this case, Mormon settlers in southern Utah used a false flag of truce to lull a group of California-bound immigrants from their circled wagons and then slaughtered them. Killed over 120 of these settlers, men, women, children. Children, I think, under the age of seven were spared, and some 17 of them were raised then by these Mormon settlers. I was quoting there from at least the first part of that from Richard Turley's book, Massacre at Mountain Meadows. Richard Turley, Glenn Leonard, and Ronald Walker. I'm also talking in this part of for the full hour on Access Utah with Julie Jensen, whose play Two-Headed, which is in part about living in the shadow of this massacre, is being produced this week at Utah State University, I believe 7:30 each evening. And tomorrow, there'll be a panel discussion following the play that will involve Mr. Turley, Julie Jensen, and my other guest for this hour, Brian Patrick, whose film Burying the Past will be shown preceding the play tomorrow night at 5 o'clock. You're welcome to join this conversation if you would like at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or email us at upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. Interesting themes, of course, and questions. What does this say about these people? What does it say about religion generally? How could this have happened? And what is it like living in the shadow of such a tragedy? When you know and don't know, as Julie Jensen says. And how can you reconcile? It especially interests Mr. Patrick. Again, for the hour, we're talking about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, 1-800-826-1495. We have Mr. Patrick back with us, some phone troubles, but I believe we have you back with us, do we not?
I'm here.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, you have a sort of a different perspective. Julie Jensen grew up with this, had family members involved. Mr. Turley, of course, in with the perspective of the church. You come in with it from the outside and learn about this in the history of the your adopted state. What was your reaction when you learned about this?
Well, it seemed like a story of injustice, and you know, like I mean, a massacre of all these people. You know, why did it happen? And you know, one of the things you haven't brought up that no one really wants to bring up is, what really was the church's position on this? And, you know, did Brigham Young order the massacre? That's always been the underlying question. Personally, I don't really believe that he did order, you know, all those deaths, but probably helped create an atmosphere for the whole thing to happen, like they were saying before. You know, it gets down to, like a horrible crime that gets out of control, and almost the reaction trying to cover the crime up is worse than the crime itself. The crime being that they attacked this wagon train, probably because they wanted to prove some sort of point to the federal government that they were the only ones to control the Indians. And if they, and the road to California, and if the federal government didn't behave and let them alone, that they were going to let the Indians have their way. Well, you know, it was an event that really sort of got out of control. The Indians left. The men dressed up as Indians. I think they feared that that people had escaped and could run off to California and tell the story. That would be the very worst thing that could happen, you know, to the Mormons at that time, is you know, Californians learned that they were dressing up as Indians and attacking wagon trains. Oh my God! So they did what criminals do, and that's cover it up. And you know, it's just the aftermath of this is just something too, you know, horrible to mention. Mm. That's my kind of take on the whole thing in a nutshell, really, why it happened.
And a little later, I want to get into the reconciliation. I know that was very interesting to you. I think the whole reason you got involved, how could people reconcile?
Yeah, I think the most fascinating part of the film, really, and it's about Mountain Meadows Massacre, but it's really about how these descendants have, you know, dealt with and struggled with this event. I mean, how people, you know, like, for example, from the Fancher Party or, you know, learned about this through, you know, their families, and how, you know, the people of the John D. Lee family and others, the Adair family and others that were really involved with the killing had really struggled with this whole event. I think that that's, in a sense, what Julie Jensen's play is also about, from a personal point of view. How does one live with this kind of tragedy, you know, in their, you know, background, you know, from what their ancestors have done, you know, something, you know, so horrible that, you know, you, it can't be mentioned, that it's always underlined, you know, like family affairs and so forth. Fascinating story, though, in that sense.
Well,
and that's why I was really compelled to get involved with it. Because here were very, you know, real people that, that were alive today that were, you know, going through this struggle. And if you look at the John D. Lee family, I mean, that's really something, because their whole family was ostracized. And you know, they were really part of the church. I mean, John D. Lee was Brigham Young's, one of their Brigham Young's adopted sons. And then all of a sudden, you know, he was executed for the crime, and they were their whole family was out in the cold. And how could you be like such a dedicated Mormon family, you know, in Southern Utah, and be ostracized by the church, the very reason why you're there in the first place? So this was something that the whole family has struggled with all along.
Let me turn to Julie Jensen. This is an interesting question, and you experienced it. How can a community live with this, sort of knowing and not knowing? There must be corrosive effects.
Well, I think there are. There's no question about that. But truth is better than silence. Even though the truth is painful sometimes, it is better than silence. All that happens in the silence is that your mind takes over and makes it up or devises new versions. In the play, I have two people. One is a devout Mormon and one is not. So their responses to this experience are exactly polar opposite. One thinks that the bloodshed that day is but another rung on the ladder of salvation, and the other one thinks that, of course, it's reprehensible. So that we get a sense of how it polarizes people and how it operates on their imaginations in the absence of truth.
It's two women,
yes.
And each scene takes them forward 10 years, I understand. So tell me a little bit more about these two characters.
One, like I say, is not a very good Mormon, or at least these events probably thrust her in the opposite direction. And her father was in the massacre, was a part of the massacre. She saw things that she shouldn't have seen, and she saw things that have then colored the rest of her life. So we watch her, and then we watch Hetty, who is her friend, her childhood friend, and she is a devout Mormon and a devout, obedient young woman. And she goes into polygamy. She marries her friend's father, the guy that was a part of the massacre. And so the events of the latter part of the 19th century are also a part of this play. The massacre is where it begins, and we take them up through the end of polygamy and statehood, which happens in the latter part of the 19th century.
And these two women rely on each other while fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. They are devoted in some inextricable way because they're tied by events, not only of their families, but their own events, their own experiences. So they're tied together even though they're different kinds of people.
Hmm. We heard in that excerpt from Contemporary Western Women you found a way into this, you said, when you thought of the items from the massacre that these women perhaps would have.
Well, I think, one doesn't understand what life in southern Utah was like in that period unless you truly understand absolute poverty. They did not have anything extra, nothing. So they were scratching a living from rather forbidding land, and they did it. They succeeded, but it was not easy. The Fencher Party was one of the wealthiest immigrant parties that ever went through the state of Utah. They had a lot of money. They had a lot of stuff, a lot of cattle. Indeed, that was part of the problem. They had so many cattle was one of the problems. So the Mormons looked at all of these cattle, not that they wanted them particularly, but that they were eating the forage for their own cattle. So it was problematic from the start. So the items, little stuff, things, I use a locket and a kind of camisole thing, that would be just odd in the world that these little girls inhabited. What are you doing with these things? What are they? Where did they come from? Certainly kids wouldn't have this kind of stuff. They wouldn't know silk. They'd never seen silk, probably. Wouldn't certainly not have a gold locket, that, not unless it belonged to their grandmother, and then they wouldn't be wearing it every day. So it's just odd items that would have been strange in their world, and so that was my access to it. I incidentally ran into somebody who said that there's a story that up here in northern Utah, in Logan, that there's a barn built from the wagon wood, the wood from the wagons in the Mountain Meadow Massacre. I doubt that. But anyway, the story persists. Mm. So that even up here there were at least stories about where that stuff went. And we know they took the wagons. We know that the Indians got some of the stuff, but they took the wagons. And they didn't just bury wagons. They took the stuff. They needed it.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. We're talking about the play, Two-Headed. Playwright is Julie Jensen, and her play is being produced on the Utah State University campus this week, 7:30 each evening, in the Morgan Theater in the Chase Fine Arts Center on the USU campus. Tomorrow, preceding the play at 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the USU Performance Hall, is a free screening of the documentary about the massacre, Burying the Past, by Brian Patrick. He's also one of my guests in this hour. And co-author of the book Massacre at Mountain Meadows is Richard Turley, who's assistant church historian and recorder for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also my guest in this hour. You're welcome to join this conversation if you'd like to at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or email us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Richard Turley, What's your take on that important question that Brian Patrick brought up? What did Brigham Young know, and was he involved in any way?
That was a focus of the research that my co-authors and I did. Maybe I could preface that by just sort of giving my perspective on this whole situation. I was not born in Utah. I was born in the state of Texas. My parents come from my father from Texas, my mother from the state of Missouri. My father's mother is from Cedar City, Utah, which, of course, was the place where the massacre was planned and orchestrated. And so even though I've done research to try to find out if I had any ancestors who were involved in the massacre, I don't have any direct line ancestors, but certainly my ancestors, they intermarried with the family lines of people who did carry out the massacre. So that's my father's side. My mother's from Missouri, as I mentioned, but her father is from Carroll County, Arkansas, which is, of course, the area from which the victims of the massacre came. And again, I've done genealogical research to see if I had any direct line relatives who were victims of the massacre, and I haven't found any. But I do have one of my grandfather's cousins who was related to 22 of the victims of the massacre. I grew up sort of seeing both of these culture regions, the culture region of southern Utah and the culture region of northwest Arkansas and southwestern Missouri, the Ozark region as it's often called. And I came to appreciate and understand people from both regions. And so when I heard the story of the massacre, I noticed a kind of polarization that tended to take place in the massacre literature, with some people saying on the one side, well, you know, people on this side of the story were devils incarnate, and then people on the other side of the story saying, no, people on the other side were devils incarnate. And having known both culture regions, I would say, you know, neither one of those accounts is very believable to me, because I've seen people from these regions, and the way I think of the massacre is not in terms of this sort of a melodrama, but in terms of the historian's craft, which is to try to find out what the evidence was. So my co-authors and I did extensive research with our research assistants. We did research in 31 states plus the District of Columbia, a lot of time spent at the National Archives. We were amazed to find that the evidence on the Mountain Meadows Massacre is scattered so widely across the country. We brought that material together. It's all now available at the Church History Library for anybody to use. And we then sat down and tried to condense all of this data that we had found to see what story it told. We were very open to the possibility that Brigham Young ordered the massacre. To us, if he ordered it, that's the story we were going to tell. As we sorted out the evidence fell a different direction, very much in what in the realm that Brian described it, with Brigham Young playing a role in establishing the kind of environment in which the massacre occurred, but not having a direct role in ordering the massacre. That being said, there are people who want to say, well, this wasn't a church event. And to say it wasn't a church event depends upon your perspective. Latter-day Saints have a tendency to think that something is not church unless it is somehow or another orchestrated at the very highest echelons of the church organizational structure. And that's because there are two types of churches generally in the United States. There are hierarchical churches, and there are sort of churches that are congregational in nature, where the authority seems to rest at the bottom, where they, you know, they choose their own ministers and so forth. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is hierarchical in the sense that it's, in general, the most authoritative direction comes top-down. So when Latter-day Saints see an event that occurs that doesn't have top-down direction, their initial inclination is to say, well, this wasn't done by the church. But if your perspective instead is from the perspective of people who belong to churches that are congregational in nature, and you see the power resting at the bottom, and you see these people at the local level who have important positions, like Isaac Haight was a stake president, William Dame, Julie Jensen's relative, was a stake president, Philip Klingensmith was a bishop. You see these high-level local people making decisions, and they're clearly making decisions at the local level with fellow church members, then people look at it and say, well, how can you say that that's not a church event? So, again, I think the answer to the question of church involvement depends a lot upon your perspective of what constitutes a church role.
We do have a caller. Let's bring in Thomas in Roosevelt. Welcome to the program.
Yes, my daughter, our second daughter, she had done some research, and she had found that my wife's mother's 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 mother survived the Mountain Meadow Massacre, and I don't believe that it was a church authorized. I watched I talked with the Lee family and the Springville area. They blame it on the church, but I just blame it on individuals going their own wrong way. Now, we had a daughter, our third daughter, was a victim of what I call a Mountain Valley manslaughter. She was a victim of manslaughter. It was reckless endangerment by her employer, but OSHA wouldn't get involved, and they said it was a state problem, and the governor at that time, Levitt, he had the state destroy the evidence, Mr. Beach and the DOT. So I don't know. I don't blame the church, that on the church. It's just individuals in the church. We've also had a ward member, a neighbor, actually invade the family privacy with a subpoena to her employer on what her death benefits were. Now, I got him prosecuted on a felony, and the hard part was getting his temple recommend removed. A lot of members of the church, they just have the attitude that if they're a good standing Mormon, then they're not suspect. Why, we can't investigate them. They're too good of people.
Well, thanks.
So go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, let the our guest respond here. Thanks for the question. Appreciate it.
You bet.
So let me turn to Mr. Turley first. You were speaking about this. Who is responsible? You know, this. I mean, certainly the individuals, but is there some culpability up the line with the church?
I think what you heard with this call was somebody who was talking about another situation. Of course, none of us on the line knows anything about that situation, but he was talking about the people that he said were church members who played a role in something that was also terrible. And he was trying, in his way, to say that while he viewed them as members of the church, he didn't view the horrible thing that happened as being orchestrated by the church. And that's, you know, that's one perspective. As I said, there's generally two perspectives on this, with some people saying, well, look, if it's not top-down directed, it is not a church orchestrated event, because in hierarchical churches like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in order to be official, it has to be top-down directed. I think that's a perspective that a lot of Latter-day Saints have. But from the perspective of people who aren't Latter-day Saints and who come from traditions that are more congregationally based, where the local people, by their actions, essentially have the authority of a church and direct things, they may see it from a different perspective, because they see the local members of the church in the Cedar City, Parowan area, Washington area, carrying out these crimes, and they say, well, they were all members of that church, therefore we can come to a different conclusion.
Mm. Let me turn.
I think an interesting
yes,
thing,
go ahead.
If I could interrupt at this point,
yes.
An interesting thing about this case is that really only one man suffered. I know they suffered. They all suffered because it was, they felt huge guilt afterwards. But John D. Lee is the only one who really legally suffered for this event.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way that John D. Lee killed 120-odd people. He couldn't have. And, of course, there were many, many other people involved. And they simply took an oath not to say anything about it, and none of the rest of them were punished for it in the legal way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that opened the gate then for the rest of the world, really, to say, what the hell is going on, and how come that was allowed to happen? John D. Lee, he had two trials. They were held in Beaver, by the way, where I'm from. The first trial, he was acquitted, and the second trial, of course, he was found guilty and ultimately executed. But I think that's a source. Not, the events themselves are a source of problem. But I think also in terms of what happened to the people involved, that only one person really takes the rap for this is and was a very problematic outcome for these events.
Yeah,
and if I could break in very quickly here, you know, even if Brigham Young did not order the massacre, he certainly, you know, as governor of the territory and head of the church, covered up, you know, was head of the cover-up. You know, this was the worst thing that could happen, is to let this story get out to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm certain that he helped engineer the cover-up of this crime.
I appreciate those two perspectives on the aftermath. Mr. Turley, I don't know what your perspective is on that.
Let me address the case of John D. Lee, which, because it's a very fascinating situation. I've spent a lot of years pulling together with colleagues all of the materials relating to the prosecution of people who had a role in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Appendix C of our book, beginning on page 255, lists all of the people who we believe had a role in the massacre, and it's not individual violence. It is not just John D. Lee. This is group violence. Mass killings tend to be group violence. And so the question becomes, how in the world then did John D. Lee end up as the only man to be executed? Well, in 1874, what we today would call a federal grand jury secretly indicted 9 men for their roles in the massacre. One of those men was Julie Jensen's relative, William H. Dame, who was the man who gave the authority to carry out the massacre. One of them was Isaac Haight in Cedar City. One of them was Philip Klingensmith there in Cedar City. Another one was John Higbee, and on it goes, 9 men. Those 9 men became the subjects of potential arrest. More than half of them ended up in the custody of the federal officials. The initial prosecutorial efforts on the part of the federal officials was to go after William Dame, because he was the person in highest authority, both from a military standpoint and from a church standpoint, in southern Utah, who they knew had a role in all of this. So their goal was to go after Dame, and in order to go after him, they needed evidence. And so, as typically happens today in a modern kind of conspiracy case, prosecutors are going to go after and indict what they consider to be the biggest fish in their net, and then they're going to use a little fish to try to cop on a big fish so they can use that evidence. And that's exactly what they did in this case. They had 2 men in custody initially, and those were William Dame, who gave up without a fight, and John D. Lee, who gave up in a fairly dramatic sort of way. They found him underneath a pile of materials that in those days would have been used to shelter chickens. So people sometimes say he was found in a chicken coop. He had guns. One of his wives had a gun trained on the officers who were trying to arrest him. It was this dramatic standoff that ends up with his arrest. So they have these 2 in custody. So they look at Dame and they say, he's the man we want. He's the big fish. And so we need to get the little fish, John D. Lee in this case, to testify against him. So they go to John D. Lee's lawyers and they say, all right, you know, your client's in real big trouble here. And the only way that he's going to get out from underneath this trouble is if he's willing to prepare a written confession about all of this. So they offer him a plea bargain. The plea bargain basically says, if you even agree to write a confession, we'll drop one of the 2 counts against you. And if your confession is quote-unquote satisfactory, we'll drop the other count and you walk free. Lee talked that over with his lawyers, and they said, you know, this is probably the best deal you're going to get. So he sat down to write a supposed confession, and it was incomplete. And so at the end of that exercise, they said to him, your confession is not satisfactory, and we don't have the evidence we need to go after Mr. Dame, so we're going to go after you. So that's how Lee ends up being the focus of the prosecution. Now, they hang on to Dame for a while. They eventually let him go at the beginning of the second Lee trial. They bring these other people into custody, and many of them are in prison for a long period of time. But eventually, the only person that they're able to get the evidence on is Lee. And so he's the one that ends up being executed. People ask me, is John D. Lee a scapegoat? And I said, well, it depends upon your meaning of that term. If by scapegoat you mean a person who is completely innocent, who becomes the fall guy for people who are not, then John D. Lee doesn't fit that definition because he clearly had blood on his hands. But if you mean the Old Testament type of scapegoat, a creature upon whom the sins of the many are laid and who then becomes, you know, the sort of single individual who takes the brunt of all that, then clearly John D. Lee's a scapegoat in that sense.
We're running out of time, but I want to turn to appreciate all the comments. I want to turn to Brian Patrick. You're one of the people whose stories are told in your documentary, Burying the Past, is Nancy Cifrone. As you mentioned, one of the survivors, the younger children were spared and raised by the very people who had murdered their families.
Right.
What happened to these children? What did they have memories of that horrible event? Were they totally assimilated into the Mormon culture there? What happened?
Well, they were there for 2 years until the federal government picked them up and brought them back to Arkansas. And, of course, those children grew up, got married, and had children, and now it's their descendants that actually are telling the story in the film. I just want to say also, too, that, in my film, really the only evidence of the massacre, the actual bones or remains of the victims are in there. And just a quick story about that is that I originally started making this film about the rebuilding of the monument. And then about a month before the dedication in 1999, this backhoe uncovered these remains. And it's really kind of amazing because, like, just a couple months before that, they had done a number of forensic tests on the ground and everything and couldn't find anything. And I remember coming home after filming that and hearing on television on KSL that, Dick Norris said, they didn't find any evidence of anything down at the massacre site. Maybe it didn't happen there. In fact, maybe it didn't even happen at all. Chuckle, chuckle. And I think, you know, this is the sort of like, I think feeling that like a lot of people have in Utah, is that maybe this is a story that was fostered upon them. Mm. That it really isn't as bad and as big as it really was. But the evidence of those bones that are in the movie, you know, showing the people that were shot execution style, you know, in the forehead and the back of the head, you know, we're talking about, you know, women and children, 120 men, women, and children, and just a horrific crime that was covered up. And actually, they didn't really do much burying of the victims. They pretty much either put them in shallow graves where animals could dig them up or just left them there. And it was just a horrible place for many, many decades. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say also, too, is that it's nice to see that the film helped make this into, one of the things that helped contribute to making this into a national historic landmark. And, the film was shown in Washington, and it was, we're real happy about it being national historic landmark status, because when you think about it, that the church does own that land where the massacre site is, it's a little bit like, the Nazis owning Auschwitz. How can you tell that story? But I will say that the Mormon Church has done really come forth and done a very good job trying to do the best they can and building a beautiful monument and
we'll
keeping
have to,
the place up.
I'm sorry, we'll have to leave it there. We're totally out of time. But I should say that our listeners can come to a panel discussion. This discussion will be continued with my three guests here. That's following the play tomorrow night. The play is Two-Headed. The playwright is Julie Jensen, and the panel discussion will follow. It will include Julie Jensen along with Richard Turley, who's a co-author of Massacre at Mountain Meadows, and Brian Patrick, who's the filmmaker of Burying the Past documentary. That documentary will be shown in the USU Performance Hall 5 p.m. Tomorrow afternoon. Then there's the play, and then the panel discussion will follow. Thank you to each of you for joining me for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is UPR.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from Handel's Messiah with the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra, directed by Craig Jessup, this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. in the USU Kent Concert Hall. Information and tickets are at American Festival Chorus.